Some of the most pivotal moments and things that I think have been impactful are not the things that happen in the Bitcoin ecosystem or the advancements by its proponents, but rather the self-owns of the detractors, the haters, the authoritarians. It's, you know, look at all the countries that banned Bitcoin over the years and how well that worked out for them. Or more recently, you know, the Federal Reserve being pressed and saying, you know, there is an infinite amount of cash, you know, and essentially creating a meme, the money printer go burr, which, you know, hit the mainstream consciousness and has helped, you know, propel once again Bitcoin into mainstream thought.
Welcome to the Swan Signal Podcast, a production of Swan Bitcoin, the best way to accumulate Bitcoin with automatic recurring buys at swanbitcoin.com. Swan Signal pairs great guests for compelling discussions about Bitcoin and economics. And this week, we have Jameson Lopp, co-founder and CTO of Casa, and Eric Martindale of Fabric. Pairing up great guests is a unique format in the Bitcoin content space and, in my opinion, absolutely deserves consideration for a spot in your rotation. Should you agree, you can subscribe at swansignalpodcast.com and youtube.com/swansignal. So glad you found your way here. Enjoy. All right, Swan fans, welcome back to Swan Signal Live. This is, of course, a production of Swan Bitcoin. Swan Signal is a weekly show that pairs up great guests for compelling discussions about Bitcoin and economics. I am your host, Brady Swenson, head of education at Swan. Before we dive into today's great discussion with two great Bitcoiners, a quick word about the service we provide here at Swan. We have built the best way to accumulate Bitcoin with automatic recurring buys. You can very simply connect your bank account, and you'll auto-fund USD into your Swan account. We'll automatically stack sats for you, and you can optionally set up automatic withdrawals to your wallet to hold your own keys, as is best practice in Bitcoin. We do all that at very, very low fees in the industry. We're up to 80% lower than Coinbase, absolutely crushing Coinbase. Delete Coinbase, move over to Swan, Bitcoin only for the win. We're also 57% cheaper than Cash App on the fees. So there's really no reason to be auto stacking anywhere else in the United States except for Swan. And in case you missed it, we are launching our daily frequency soon. So you can be able to buy on the daily with your Swan accounts. I've had massive demand for daily since the day we launched. It is coming. So go to swanbitcoin.com/daily buys and you'll be among the first daily stackers on the Swan squad. All right, let's get into this one. We have two Bitcoin legends with us today. Both have been around since the very early years of the project. Very well-respected Bitcoin developers. I'm really excited to get to have the opportunity to talk with these guys and share it with you all. First, we have Jameson Lopp, co-founder and CTO of Casa. Thanks for joining us, Lopp. How's it going, man?
Great. Happy to be here with my bearded brethren.
I have a little work to do to catch up with you guys. And the other gentleman with us today here is, of course, Eric Martindale. He's currently working on the Fabric protocol, an early layer 3 system for Bitcoin. Thanks for being here, Eric.
Yeah, awesome to be here. Good to see you again, Jameson. Apparently the beard comes with the crypto knowledge. You know, it kind of grows out as you learn more, right?
It sounds good. That sounds about right. At least I have a little bit going on, so I guess I've earned a little bit of knowledge over these couple of years. All right, so let's dive into this one. As I said, of course, these guys have been around for a long time. And, you know, whenever I get a chance to speak with Bitcoiners who have been, you know, here for most of the life of the project, I think it's really, really valuable to dive into some history. And we can, you know, us who are sort of newer to Bitcoin, I've been around for a few years now, and I know a lot of you watching are even more recent than that. It's really valuable to kind of learn about and get perspective from the history of the project. We're going to dive into some history, and it's going to be a lot of fun. But I think to kind of set the scene in context, I'd really like to take a moment to consider, you know, the present moment that we find ourselves in Bitcoin, because it's a very unique one, even in the history of this, you know, very exciting project that's filled with, you know, unique events. So we're living in a time where, you know, the case for Bitcoin is really standing stark, you know, even more stark than ever against a backdrop of, you know, Keynesian monetary policy run amok. It's a time where some of the world's biggest investors and even the biggest companies in the world are investing in Bitcoin and converting their cash reserves to Bitcoin. It's kind of surreal in this particular year. I don't think any of us saw all of this sort of mashing together into a 6-month period so soon. So Jameson, we'll start with you, then we'll go to Eric. You know, what's it like for you personally, having been in Bitcoin for so long, to experience, you know, these events unfold as they are before us?
You know, when I think back on, you know, the things that I find like most gratifying, you know, it's not the fact that like the Bitcoin price went up so much. It's just that like my crazy rants from 8 years ago actually turned out to be pretty accurate. And all the folks who said I was crazy have to eat their words now. And, you know, it's, you don't want to dwell too much on the, like, I told you so stuff. Because there's always going to be some element of that. I mean, whenever you're talking about, you know, massive fundamental changes and shifts in, you know, society and economics and so on, then obviously there will be a lot of skeptics, and it's in many cases impossible to convince someone of a potential future, you know, actually being possible. And then, you know, we just see that that's like the one constant, is that the world continues to get weirder, and now it seems like even the most implausible theories about what might happen in the next few years suddenly seem a lot more possible.
Yeah, Eric, how are you feeling, man? I mean, is this surreal for you to watch all this happening?
Yeah, it is super surreal. You know, I definitely came at this sort of from the libertarian angle initially, and then I've sort of, I guess, evolved into an anarchist over time. But it really has been just an incredible series of events, right? You know, you used to be the tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist talking about, you know, the inflation from the Fed and, you know, how the fiat currency was going to collapse. And even, you know, even just a few years ago, it was really hard to, you know, say that anything that's happening right now was ever going to happen. Right. It was all sort of like a very distant idea in the mind. Right. It was a way of, you know, just trying to teach people about fiat systems and central banking and so on, and try to get them more aware of what's going on in the world and how they can actually affect change rather than, you know, going through the political system. But, you know, just coming in, I mean, where we are now, it's just like a few years ago, we didn't even see this coming. Right. So it was just sort of like, so it's almost like a dream, right? It's a cypherpunk dream, you know, in a way. It's basically everything that the original cypherpunks talked about back in the day. You know, when Satoshi came out with his white paper, you know, he really hit on all of those points extremely well in all of the talkings and postings that he shared initially. And, you know, we're what, almost 12 years in, I think, at this point, something like that. It's gone even further than I think most people, even in the very beginning days when there was a lot of, you know, crazy ranty libertarians running around on the forums talking about the collapse of the fiat system. But we're witnessing it before our eyes, just with like the latest round of inflation, you know, global pandemic, and the government's just printing more and more money, basically, to in an attempt to address the issue.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and at this point, you know, as we've discussed many times on this podcast and elsewhere as Bitcoiners, you know, there's really no other way out at this point. We are, in terms of the, Federal Reserve and US government, meaning citizens of the United States are committed, whether we like it or not, to this path of, Keynesian monetary policy, and ride or die. So, fortunately, we have this escape hatch, this plan B. I'd like to know what, like, Jameson, how do you see, like, Bitcoin, a transition? How does the recent events kind of affect the way you envision a transition to Bitcoin playing out? Do you think it's going to kind of pull that future forward a bit?
I think it was a combination of people being locked inside for a long time and all of the macro events giving them more of an opportunity to investigate some of these issues that people generally go most of their lives not thinking about, that has resulted in a resurgence of like new inbound interest. Now, obviously, there have been the more public, like well-known investors and other public figures who have come forward to, you know, state their own bullish case for Bitcoin. But, you know, at Casa, you know, we're just onboarding a lot of normal new coiners, you know, white collar professionals, people who they, you know, have enough wealth that they are thinking about, you know, maybe I need to diversify, maybe I need to hedge against some risks that I never really considered risks before. So, you know, these things, they are incentivizing people to actually give a look at Bitcoin. Whereas before, you know, Bitcoin was a really hard sell to people in first world countries that had good access to financial infrastructure. It was a much easier sell to people who were in third world countries that were hyperinflating or, you know, didn't have good access to banking networks. Now, you know, those of us who were deemed the crazy, you know, Austrian and libertarian folks in the first world suddenly seem a lot less crazier. And, you know, I think it's just another one of, you know, the big use cases for this technology that the value has always been there, and now it's just becoming more obvious because of the friction that people are feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah, just expand on that a little bit. You know, even in the early days, it was sort of imagined that it wouldn't be the first world countries that would adopt Bitcoin quickly. So it wouldn't be the United States. Certainly the U.S. would be the last to the table. And you can kind of draw a parallel to, for reasons for that, like in energy, in the energy industry, for example. So the United States has, you know, something like 150-year-old electrical grid, right? So this is all infrastructure that's already in place. It's already widely used. People's power, the lights stay on, you know, the water continues getting pumped. So there's really not that much room or not much more really incentive for new infrastructure to be put in place, new technology to be put in place. Whereas, you know, say in you know, the developing world, for example, you know, all sorts of places where they don't have access to robust financial services, we always sort of anticipated that that would be really be where Bitcoin started to take off first. And you could see that sort of develop, at least initially in the remittance market, for example. You know, Bitcoin is a, you know, censorship resistant money. And it allows you to hop borders, basically ignore national borders in terms of your ability to move capital. So we really saw like, for example, the Philippines, people sending back to money back to the Philippines, and using it to really just bypass these sort of these legacy regulations that are in place. So I do think it's sort of a rising swell. You know, obviously, you know, we didn't really expect the banks per se to kind of move into the Bitcoin industry as quickly as they have, say 7 or 8 years ago. It was sort of like, oh, one day, you know, 20 or 30 years down the line, you know, and now we have, you know, the national bank of, you know, number of different countries at this point, starting to talk about Bitcoin, releasing reports on Bitcoin. You got the Goldman Sachs report on Bitcoin that came out. You've got all these major financial institutions that here we are 12 years later starting to pay attention to it, because it has worked in places like Venezuela, in places like the Philippines, in all of these places where there's either onerous regulation, these draconian systems which restrict how we freely move money, or just there's an inflation problem, for example, and you see people being able to lift up their families and support and build a dream where they wouldn't have been able to otherwise, because they saw this thing on the internet, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and it happens to have a deflationary design rather than an inflationary design, And as their nation's currency collapsed, you know, they were able to lift their family up and out of that situation and move them somewhere else in a lot of cases. So I'm hearing a lot of stories like that. And, you know, that's really what energizes me about Bitcoin, is there is an actual tangible social benefit in the real world for this stuff. And then obviously, like, we could go down the rabbit hole in terms of things that you can actually do with it as a programmable money, for example. But just seeing that it's actually solving a real problem in the real world, you know, startups have to face that problem every day. So, you know, what's the problem that you're solving for your customer? And Bitcoin's use case is, you know, definitely maybe a bit esoteric for some, especially here in the developed world. But at the end of the day, you know, this is a long process, right? So that tidal wave you can start to see is really swelling. And that's reflected in the market prices. Not that anybody cares what the price of Bitcoin is in fiat currency, because it's going to get inflated all to hell. But no, I do think it's a huge groundswell, and we're still at the very very tip of that iceberg. So,
is that what you know originally inspired you about Bitcoin? Did you see it as a way for people living in regimes with already failing currencies and you know, more autocratic governments as a way to kind of opt out of the power structure there?
Yeah, definitely on the broader sense. I look at Bitcoin as the tip of the spear in the sort of slaying of this legacy idea that we need some sort of centralized institution to run society. So, I mean, frankly, government at large, this idea that some one man or one group of people can write laws which govern over somebody else. I think Bitcoin basically demonetizes those systems, it defunds them, you know, so it's a way of basically forcing them to compete in the market mm-hmm. for the services that they're providing, liberating the market to compete on services. So you know, Bitcoin being Caesarship proof, basically, it allows you to basically opt out and participate in the businesses that you're interested in, rather than, you know, having to comply with whatever onerous regulation. You know, in the U.S., we really don't even have it that bad, right? You know, we have a central bank which was created in 1913, right? And personally, I view the fact that we have a central bank that has the authority to hold a monopoly over the monetary system. You know, anytime you have a monopoly, it kills out all the it obviously kills out all the competition, but you end up with much lower quality of services at a much higher cost, right?
But it allows us to dump dollars on the rest of the world.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it puts us in a de facto tyrannical position, even if the Keynesians are well intentioned, right? Even if the Keynesians think that, you know, tweaking these dials and tuning these levers is actually going to help people improve their quality of lives. However deluded that they are, you know, the damage is real. And, you know, people say, you know, taxation is theft, right? Well, inflation is an even greater theft. I definitely agree that taxation is theft, but inflation is the more insidious one, because it steals from everybody at the same time. And there's absolutely nothing you can do about it, at least to address it directly, you mm-hmm. know. So since 1913, you know, ever since there has been a private bank that has had the authority to issue the money, and the lawmakers are directly tied to it by way of the 16th Amendment, at least here in the United States, which grants them the right to levy an apportioned tax for the first time in history, 1913, the creation of the income tax. I basically view every legal decision, every law written since that point in time, from my perspective, is illegitimate, right? Because now that you have the tight coupling, this marriage of money and state, how can you possibly hope to have a legitimate political system at all? So Bitcoin represents the separation of money and state. It's the opt out. You know, you have the voice and exit strategy, It gives you the personal sovereignty, the individual autonomy. It allows you to express your personal beliefs and decisions. And I do think that absolutely it starts in those, you know, the areas of most need. And then, you know, because the U.S. is certainly, you know, at the top of the top of the ladder, you know, they're going to be the last, they're really going to be the last to the table. So pretty much everybody who's even aware of what Bitcoin is, at least just beyond the surface level, is way ahead of the curve at this point, even now, right?
Yeah. So, all right. So Jameson, like, you know, Bitcoin itself is a large orange pill to swallow, like to relearn what money is, right? And I think for a lot of Bitcoiners, Bitcoin has done that. If you were not a gold bug before, from the libertarian kind of monetary perspective, you have been taught what money really is by Bitcoin. And that is a disorienting sort of shift in worldview. And then you start to follow the rabbit hole down all of the, you know, consequences, potential outcomes from that sort of change in the worldview. And Eric is, you know, making some, kind of walking down that rabbit hole. So as Bitcoin starts to really, you know, exert its force globally, as it already is, I think we're seeing it happen now in real time. How does this transition happen? I mean, we're not going to move directly from, like, you know, democracy is pretty lindy at this point. Like, we're not going to, you know, our current form of democracy, whatever you want to call it, like, you know, you can debate the semantics and all that, but the current form of government in the United States is going to resist change, obviously. So is the monetary policy. So there's a lot to unpack there. How do you see, like, Bitcoin affecting the way we govern our society, the way we live, and how can, like, that transition happen in any remotely, like, peaceful way, do you think?
Oh, yeah, well, that's the real question, right? And this is where the stuff, you know, talking about, like, anarcho-capitalism, you know, a potential voluntary society, it's somewhat easy to talk about, you know, living in a society that's already fully in that type of frame of reference. But how do you get from, you know, point A to point B without a lot of people killing each other? Because, you know, nobody willingly gives up their power voluntarily. That's the major problem, is that how do you take power away without a lot of bloodshed and violence and whatnot? And that is going to be, I think, a very interesting transition to watch, because if you follow through the theory, you know, some of these theories being that ultimately taking the power of controlling money away from the state will disempower it in terms of things like taxation, or basically self-funding in a variety of different ways, both through inflation and taxation, that is going to make nation states, you know, very upset. They are going to probably do some things that are violent. And the real question, I think, will be, you know, what will the timing be like on that? Will the nation states be too sluggish? Will they act too late, you know, past the point of no return, where, you know, the system has already become so decentralized and widespread that, you know, even the power of nation states, which are very powerful when they can, you know, concentrate at a single target, it's still very difficult for nation states to undergo something where they are, you know, having to fight the entire citizenry. And this is something that, you know, I've argued with people about different libertarian style arguments, you know, Second Amendment arguments, like, my entire life, is that there are a lot of people who just don't seem to understand what the real power balance is. They don't seem, well, frankly, the most nation states have done a very good job putting forward their monopoly on violence and instilling fear in the populace, so that I would say a decent proportion of people are fearful enough of their states that they think that, you know, if they do anything against the state's wishes, you know, hellfire will rain down upon them. But they don't seem to understand that, you know, even nation states are only comprised basically of, you know, a small percentage of the actual population, and that they don't have the ability to force their will against a populace that ultimately opposes them. I mean, we see this all the time, even with like dictatorships and popular uprisings. It's like, once you get a decent portion of the population to rise up, in many cases, it doesn't even matter if they're armed or not, because they will find ways to arm themselves. They will ultimately take the power that they need to, you know, fight back against whatever is upsetting them. So, you know, will there be violence? I mean, I'm sure there will. It's not going to be a completely peaceful transition. How long is it going to take? Years, decades, generations, hard to say. But in general, like Eric was saying, like, technology seems to continue to impress everyone in the pace at which it is adopted and spread. And so sooner rather than later seems to be the answer for almost everything in this space. There's still so much work to be done, though, to make the technology more user-friendly, more secure, more scalable, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have the perfect money yet, but I have believed all along that the framework under which Bitcoin was originally created, money as an open source collaborative project, you know, voluntary project where anyone who cares can contribute, is the most sound foundation that you can have.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I think like there's a pretty serious, I mean, it's a pretty serious issue with even 100 years ago here in the United States, we had a very different kind of culture, right? People were more aware of their individual autonomy at the time. So we've had a long series of, especially here in the United States, of events which have kind of led us to rely more and more on the government. And I think that's put the population in a very vulnerable position, right? I view these sort of centralized systems as, you know, vectors of attack, you know, just like Nick Szabo's famous trusted third parties are security holes. When you have a centralized government, to your point about open source, you know, it's a security threat. It's an attack vector that can be exploited. And just like we're even seeing out in the world today, you know, it's pretty dangerous times when your population gets unhappy and turns to violence to attempt to effect their political goals. But you know, the open source model, you know, anytime power is changing hands, you know, you have that sort of danger, right? But I just to hit on Jameson's point there, like the open source model, like rather than looking to take over the existing system, the existing structure, and change it to suit your whim, the better option is to build an alternative, right? And that's exactly what Satoshi did, right? That's exactly what Bitcoin represents. That's exactly why Bitcoin is an open source project that it very strictly and firmly does not have a governance component, right? There's no central committee, there's no company, there's no authority that can tell you what software you can run, at least in terms of your full node, right?
It's very difficult to convince a lot of people of that, though, and something that I've actually just started thinking about recently, and this is the problem of proving a negative, is that, you know, I've written so many like FUD debunking articles of like, does Bitcoin Core control Bitcoin? Does the Chinese miner consortium control Bitcoin? You know, it's you can't prove that something doesn't happen, right? And that's kind of where there's almost a leap of faith required for you to have like been in the space so long and looked at the system from so many different angles.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, and it's definitely, you know, coming from it from an engineering perspective, you know, knowing that, you know, pretty much, you know, for my entire life, I have almost exclusively relied on open source software. I ran Gentoo Linux for a long time, where every single program that ran on my computer, with the exception of the BIOS at the time, but even now you can replace that with open source alternatives as well, the source code was downloaded, compiled, and then built on my own machine. So it's different coming from maybe our perspective, or my perspective at least. And it's much easier to see how you do have that autonomy. But from an outsider, I agree completely. That's a very difficult hurdle to get over. You can say that, you know, the Bitcoin core developers are maintainers of one of the implementations of Bitcoin, right? But that's not very satisfying for someone, for a market that, like, really there aren't that many other alternatives. You know, there's Bcoin, there's a couple of other smaller implementations, but they just don't have a presence. And if somebody wanted to make a change for themselves, like, they don't even have the toolbox, let alone the tools in that toolbox to start making those changes. So you made a point earlier about how far we are, how much further we have to go in terms of user experience. I think that's the biggest remaining hurdle to boundary to cross, is how do we give people easier access to tools, and easier act, like, for example, the power that Bitcoin provides. You know, you guys do multi-sig, and, you know, there's all sorts of custodianship stuff that's interesting. How do we make these things easier to use and more readily ready as drop-in replacements for the existing centralized systems that they already use?
Yeah, it's just like, we would probably agree. It would be great if, you know, every American family had an AR-15 or two and a few thousand rounds of ammo. And we think that that would, you know, make the country more resilient against things like, tyrannical government attack. But you wouldn't just print up a bunch of AR-15s and go dropping them off on people's doorsteps without some, you know, training and other instruction and, trying to make these things not have literal foot guns in them.
Yeah. The education thing is also something that it definitely needs to be improved and worked on. And I think we see that kind of play out with some of the other copycats that have cropped up since Bitcoin was released. Is some of them even attacked, like, for example, Ethereum, you know, really, really tried to make the developer process easier to try to build out that ecosystem. But, you know, Bitcoin has some really, really important core principles, right, that do make it somewhat difficult to convey those ideas to people or make them accessible at least, right? But at the end of the day, it becomes a more powerful system. It's a marathon, not a sprint, right? You know, this is a 100-year plus societal change. So we can't just, like, rush into this and then not expect people to lose their money in, you know, bugged contracts and broken engineering solutions. So I definitely think the education aspect of it, not only from that engineering philosophy, that precision oriented engineering perspective, but just from the technology aspect itself, getting into the nitty gritty of how smart contracts in, like, as Bitcoin is a form of smart contract, how these systems work and why you might want certain properties versus others. And then the level above that is educating people about the utility of these things and making it accessible for them to interface with them, right? And the more of those systems that we have, obviously, and it's sort of like a funnel, right? You got to improve the education, make people aware that these things even exist. You got to teach them how to build things with them, how to use them. And then you got to make the tools not clunky and slow and awkward to use. And then you got to get the market momentum. So it's just like this huge funnel of all these, like, individual pieces that we got to get through. But at the end of the day, I think it does start with education and just continuing to share, basically, to share the overall ethos and logos for example, of what Bitcoin represents as a system.
That's what we're here for, right? I mean, a lot of us are working on, and I think we see the importance of education just because this is such a massive change. It's kind of the polar opposite of the way we've been running the show for a century. So I wonder, though. I mean, I hear you and kind of laying out the path, the funnel for adoption, but I can't help but think that we don't like that. That's not going to be up to us, right? The developers and designers aren't necessarily going to be able to be like, all right, we need to get this in this place. Now you guys can come in. It seems like, I mean, that's happening now, right? I guess the demand is rising because of events that are happening and people are waking up to Bitcoin being a better savings technology. And in that capacity as Bitcoin being a better savings technology, it seems like we're in pretty good shape at this point. I think in other use cases down the road, I agree, obviously we have a lot of work to do, and I know both of you guys are working on this. I want to get into Fabric and I want to get into Casa, but I did want to do a little bit of history stuff first. So let's hit that and then we'll finish up with what you guys are working on right now. So a question I had for you was, you know, what was the most pivotal event in Bitcoin's history and why? And can you share us, you know, give us some context and color about your experiences you went through it? And you both can't pick the four cores S2X. You have to pick one. So who wants to go first and take the low hanging fruit?
I'll take the easy low hanging fruit, right? And that would probably be Mt. Gox.
Okay.
I mean, in the early days, you know, right as Bitcoin was happening, right, you know, we had this huge financial collapse, you know, there was a lot of trust that people just kind of assumed was going to be followed through on. And we saw the 2008 financial crisis, and then pop, here comes Bitcoin, like right at the most perfect opportune moment. And, you know, it represented a lot. It was fairly cohesive, at least in the beginning, as to what it represented, right? It was a sort of a cypherpunky movement. And in the cypherpunk ideology, you know, we've been talking about this stuff for years, right? And so to see Bitcoin go just a couple years later, you know, and there was the Bitcoinica hack before that. So that was another exchange that existed. And there was a couple of other really small ones. But as Bitcoin had started to gain momentum and speed, you know, the exchange rate was going up. It went from zero, right, to $2 and then $6 and then 20 something dollars. And, you know, I don't remember exactly what the price was, probably something like 200 or something like that when Mt. Gox went down. Seeing people sort of forget what the whole thing was about, which is, you know, decentralizing that power, decentralizing the ability to have a stable, sound currency, a sound money, and putting it in the hands of the people so that it couldn't be inflated away by a Keynesian economist sitting off somewhere. And to see like Mt. Gox in particular, I think that woke a lot of people up and kind of gave us a course correction, because that really is where the not your keys, not your money meme kind of came from. Is a lot of people lost a lot of money during that debacle, and it was really unfortunate. But it was really a demonstration of exactly why you don't trust a centralized institution with your money. And if not, you treat it like an investment. So I'm really glad that, you know, the ideology, if you will, speaking broadly, has somewhat unified around this self-sovereignty aspect of what Bitcoin provides. And today we see that savings narrative kind of develop and really be defended well because of that. But I do split it into like three phases, right? Like initially it's kind of perceived as an investment for the future, for the eventual collapse of fiat currency, right? And then, you know, as we hit the middle of the S-curve, right? You know, that's the savings period, right? Now it's still an investment of sorts. The price is still going to, the value, purchasing power of Bitcoin is still going to continue to increase. And then as we hit that top of the S curve, as we achieve market penetration and more people adopt Bitcoin, then we hit that consumer adoption aspect. But I'm just super happy that, you know, we've at least many people who are in the Bitcoin ecosystem have learned their lesson about centralized systems. Unfortunately, it was an expensive lesson for some. Mm-hmm. I think I even lost a couple of Bitcoin there, but you know, c'est la vie. So, but I'm glad that meme continues. You know, not your keys, not your money.
Yeah, Jameson, I want to hear you know, your little history story for us. But you know, Casa was born out of this meme, right? I mean, that was kind of the genesis of Casa 8 years before you know, idea that you've got to get your money off exchanges as soon as possible, otherwise it's not your money. Can you talk about, like, I mean, I assume that that's something that's been motivating you to work on Casa for a long time, and you know, just like talk about how you guys have made it way easier to hold your own keys. And it's you know, I'm a customer, and you know, it's a few clicks, and it's really easy to hold your keys within a, you know, very like secure way, much more secure way than holding it on a single device.
Yeah, you know, there are a ton of things that you could talk about, point to with like the amazing advancements that the Bitcoin ecosystem has made over the years. It's, you know, especially been fascinating to watch, you know, second and third layer protocols being developed at very rapid pace because, you know, they don't need to get consensus from the entire ecosystem to do that development. As for myself, you know, I've spent the past 5 or 6 years now doing what I consider to be really, you know, boring low level work, which is just private key management. You know, it's a very fundamental problem that still has not been fully solved. Like, I won't consider this to be a solved problem until we stop hearing about people losing their keys, until we stop hearing about you know, people getting hacked and having their money stolen. Though it's really the self-loss that is I think the bigger problem, at least at this point in time. And so that's why I really say it is a lot about usability. And the, I guess, short version of, you know, what we try to do at Casa is, you know, we look out on the entire ecosystem and all of the best practices that we've learned through a lot of very hard lessons over the years. And then we ask ourselves, well, we know that basically none of the users are going to read the fucking manual. So how do we build the software to guide them through the best practices? And that's how we end up with what is a fairly simple and yet elegant interface in Casa. We actually strip out probably 99% of the possible things that you could do with the Bitcoin protocol, because most of them are foot guns. And we say, you know, this is how you get yourself into a nice, robust, manageable, like vault style cold storage setup. And there's still a lot of work to do there. I mean, there's more complexity than I would like. I've got, you know, plenty of plans for ways to continue to simplify it. It's fun to look out and see the advancements that are happening, like in the hardware device ecosystem. We're going to start to see new generations of dedicated hardware key managers come out, and, you know, continue to evaluate and look at those. And, you know, at Casa, we don't want to invent anything novel. With security, novelty is often a bad thing. We don't want to roll our own crypto. We don't want to create completely novel security models. So we're going to just keep doing what we do, ingest everything that there is to ingest, and then try to distill it down to like the most awesome bits of security and usability. But kind of like to get back to your question though, since I can't say Fork Wars or UASF or anything like that, I would actually say some of the most pivotal moments and things that I think have been impactful are not the things that happen in the Bitcoin ecosystem or the advancements by its proponents, but rather the self-owns of the detractors, the haters, the authoritarians. It's, you know, look at all the countries that banned Bitcoin over the years and how well that worked out for them. Or more recently, you know, the Federal Reserve being pressed and saying, you know, there is an infinite amount of cash, you know, and essentially creating a meme, the money printer go burr, which, you know, hit the mainstream consciousness and has helped, you know, propel once again Bitcoin into mainstream thought.
That's a great point. It's an absolutely great point. At that point, we had Bitcoin sort of just narrowed down to two memes. It was money printer go burr and Bitcoin fixes this. And that's all you need to know about Bitcoin and why the use case and the elevator pitch. I want to talk a little bit more about, by the way, thank you guys for what you guys do at Casa. I think we have, you know, still obviously a massive uphill battle on the not your keys, not your coins front, right? And as we get more people saving Bitcoin, holding Bitcoin for the long term, as I think that trend is really picking up with, you know, the massive investors coming in the space and now the MicroStrategy news that they're just turning their corporate treasury, 60% of it into Bitcoin. The Bitcoin as savings technology is, you know, out there. It's happening. So it's just going to keep ramping up over the next couple of years. Now the OCC, which is a department of the Treasury that I don't think anybody had ever heard of before this announcement, at least in Bitcoiners, I hadn't, now say that banks can custody Bitcoin legally in the United States. So it's obviously going to be the path of least resistance for people just to open up a, you know, Bitcoin account at their local bank or at the Bank of America and start saving buying their Bitcoin and putting it there, still in custody or whatever, or maybe Bank of America starts selling Bitcoin probably, right? How do you see us, besides just building the products and having them out there, and obviously education's a piece of it, but do you have hope that we'll be able to keep most or at least enough Bitcoin off of out of third party, you know, large central third parties custodianship?
I personally think absolutely. I think just looking at the technology development and seeing how at certainly in the Bitcoin space, but far less so in the alternative, right? So all of the other altcoins, you know, they're all locking their funds up in other people's multi-sig, throwing their money in exchanges. It's kind of ridiculous to watch that all happen. But meanwhile, you know, in Bitcoin space, you know, we have, you know, the name is escaping me right now, but it's a desktop trading app, basically. It doesn't have an exchange, but we're seeing the development.
BISC.
Thank you. It used to be BitSquare. That's why I was like, I can't remember. BISC. That's right. So we have BISC. You know, I'm working on a project called Portal through Fabric, which is trying to use Bitcoin's HTLC components to build these decentralized or these contracts that don't rely on central depositorship. I definitely think the technology is there. But just like we kind of covered in the beginning of the call, it has to be usable, right? That's the tough part. And quite frankly, I mean, centralized systems, especially exchanges, and the potential opportunities to make money, which are capital investments rather than savings, and it's more of a gamble than it is just buy and hold, right? So there's a bit of a mentality, there's a psychology thing that has to go on there as well. These systems are like definitely in their fledgling state, but they exist. And that the fact that we see them so early in Bitcoin's development is a very, very positive sign, right? So the fact that that meme has stuck around, not your keys, not your coin, the fact that everything other than Bitcoin, the fact that, you know, centralized systems continue to get hacked, right? These honeypots, these aggregators, where instead of, you know, where if I can go rob, you know, the bank rather than having to go around pickpocketing 200,000 people to get the same amount of money, I'm going to go rob the bank, right? So it's going to continue happening. You know, in other more poorly thought out systems, you know, the security bugs are going to continue happening. These flaws are going to continue getting exposed. And it, I just think that, that trend continues. I mean, sure, the overall volume of, you know, influx into Bitcoin is definitely going to continue to grow. Even the trading across the altcoin markets is going to continue to grow. Centralized exchanges are going to continue to grow. But as that continues, as the technology develops out, the proportion of alternative decentralized systems, or at least trust minimized systems, is also going to grow, and as a proportion, not as a direct, as a linear metric. So I definitely think, yeah, the savings aspect is a huge component of that. And the fact that, you know, you can put your Bitcoin onto, you know, onto a steel key, you can stamp it into a sheet of steel, and then, you know, bury it in your backyard, and then come back to it in 20 years. And then go purchase your rocket and fly to Europa, right? So that is the sort of time scale that, you know, I think that's the low time preference, but I think, you know, a lot of Bitcoiners at this point are starting to look at. So I do think the portion of the market, however fast it continues to grow, that is relying on trust, is going to continue to demonstrate its previous pattern of failure, and that portion is going to continue to shrink as people realize how, like, what is actually going on.
But, you know, there were even early adopters like Hal Finney who opined upon the idea that, you know, maybe Bitcoin does end up mostly being held in vaults by banks, you know, kind of like gold as a, you know, reserve currency. And even though that would not be optimal in terms of, you know, entire anti-fragility of the system, we would at least still have the ability to audit, you know, the total supply. We know that they're not inflating it. You know, there's no central bank that control it. But I think that this is fundamentally one of the things that I'm fighting against, is that unless we continue to build more and more user-friendly self-custody products, that is an inevitable future, because we know what the average person is, you know, capable and willing to do in terms of, you know, amount of time and effort that they want to spend thinking about managing their money. So we do need to make self-custody sufficiently robust that people are confident that they can do it themselves. This is a recurring theme that I hear in the system is, you know, sure, there are a lot of newbies out there who don't even really know the difference, and so they never withdraw from wherever they buy. But there's also quite a few people who do know the difference, but they're not confident enough. And they do believe that, you know, leaving their keys with a trusted entity that has a bunch of specialists that, you know, worry about the security of those keys is for them possibly a better risk reward ratio than taking on the onus and the responsibility of self-custody.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that, I mean, I love hearing, I mean, it makes sense. I hadn't thought about it that way, Eric, that, you know, the centralization is going to centralization. They're going to do what it does. It's going to fail. And those, it's going to continue. I mean, Mt. Gox lessons will continue to happen and push people toward the easy, you know, easy solutions like Casa. All right, I want to dive into Fabric. I don't know much about Fabric, and I think it's probably the same for a lot of people watching today. And really excited to hear about, you know, this. It's a new layer three protocol, which is just kind of cutting edge in and of itself, because we're sort of, you know, we have some layer two protocols that Bitcoiners have kind of gotten used to, Lightning and Liquid. I also know that you were involved in Liquid. So if you want to comment on, like, how you think the state, you know, how you Liquid has evolved, and comment on that, and also tell us about Fabric. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, sure. So just to kind of give the overview. Fabric is starts from the origin, the idea of building what's called an information market, right? So this is a an exchange, if you will, an order book of information that you can buy and sell, and Fabric is intending to build a system which utilizes Bitcoin's HTLC and smart contracting capabilities to allow you to participate in the exchange of information without having to rely on a centralized authority. So perhaps the biggest application that you know that historically would benefit from this model or has been built that somewhat represents it is the World Wide Web, right? So right now, I mean, it radically changed the world much in the same way, although perhaps a little bit less over the long term than Bitcoin has. But the World Wide Web is this idea that you have these documents, these pages that live on a server, and your web browser acts like request. You get a link to one either from another web page that you've already visited, or or you type it in, or through a search engine these days, or what have you, and you discover this document. So the simplest case is that rather than sort of your web browser sending a request to the server to download this document from that implicitly centralized authority, why not broadcast a request that has some attached amount of Bitcoin, for example, that says, hey, if you can get me this document that I'm this piece of information that I'm looking for, you can claim this money on the flip side, right? So there is a construction known as a zero knowledge contingent payment. And basically by delivering the document that I requested, you now can spend the funds that I bonded into my initial request.
Cool.
So yeah, it's, I mean, if you're familiar with HTTP, I think it's HTTP 402 or something like that, payment required, right? It would be an alternative, almost it could be an upgrade to the existing World Wide Web, but unfortunately, the way the World Wide Web as an application that sits on top of the internet, the World Wide Web has so many points of centralization in it already, right? HTTP as a protocol design is already pretty much, you know, it's implicitly centralized, right? You're sending a request from a client to a server, so it's in the protocol design, all the way down to DNS, right? So there's a centralized authority on DNS. There's ICANN, which controls internet IP address, the IP addresses, the domain name system, and all the way down to BGP and the routing protocol. I mean, BGP is certainly a lot better than as a routing protocol. That's the fundamental layer at the base of the internet that determines how traffic moves around the internet, right? So that's probably the single biggest application, but there's a lot of components, and we've actually been working on this project to some extent since 2015. Even before I joined Blockstream, I had just come out of BitPay, where at the time BitPay was actually really interested in things like payment channels and building open source stuff. But there was a fundamental shift in BitPay's philosophy at around the 2014 timeline. And unfortunately, they went a different direction. So that summer in 2015, I wanted to take a lot of the ideas that we had come up with and build something around them. So just to describe the layer three thing, you know, Bitcoin is the base layer. We say layer one. In the monetary world, we might even say M0. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's the amount of physical currency that actually exists. At least in the case of Bitcoin, it's the base supply. The Bitcoin blockchain is obviously a very expensive distributed database, right? It's a database that's probably going to last for at least 10,000 years, I think, right? If you put something into this database, you know that it's going to be there for an extremely long time. Right. So and it has thermodynamic security properties, et cetera. We all know all of that stuff. So it makes a lot of sense to use that kind of system as an anchoring point for a layer two system, And you see this taking shape exactly in the form of Lightning and Liquid. And you know, Lightning is a payment channel network. Payment channels have been talked about, you know, for a long time, all the way back, you know, at least as far as 2012, I think. Certainly, I'm sure there's been posts on the forums before that. I'm pretty sure. And it's this idea that you have, rather than set like immediate, like putting the transaction into the network and letting it confirm in a block, right? You simply exchange information with a group of peers and update a single transaction or a group of transactions over time. And then if you choose, you can then settle back out onto the chain if you want to, or like the Lightning approach, which was a, you know, there was a group of projects around that time that kind of had very similar ideas. And I think we're very fortunate that Lightning has developed as far as it has. But instead of settling back out on chain, your payment channel, you can use that as input into another payment channel and build a network of those payment channels. So that's your layer two network. You know, where Bitcoin has, you know, this 10-minute interval between block times, right? So it actually doesn't really make that much sense in terms of like internet payments, right? Mm-hmm. You know, especially when you want to pay an invoice. You know, you don't want to wait, you know, one confirmation for it, let alone really the 3 or 6 or 12 that you really should be waiting to guarantee that you have that money, right? So these layer two systems really give an opportunity to kind of use the Bitcoin base layer properties and adapt them into something that's a little bit more target specific. And payments is very specifically one that is obvious, right? Lightning does instant payments, and you have instant understandings and guarantees about whether or not your funds are good. Mm-hmm. So Fabric sits at layer three. So if we look at this as a protocol stack, right, we have the settlement layer, we have a payment layer where there's instantaneous movement of funds. At layer three, we do what's called computation, right? So this is where we build actual machines or programs which can run inside of these networks. So if you wanted to implement, for example, a Turing machine, you would be able to do that here safely at layer three, rather than implementing it, for example, at layer one, like Ethereum chose to do. A Turing system, you would be able to pay for each cycle in the contract. Mm-hmm. Basically passing messages around from peer to peer, we don't call this, the academic community calls this secure multi-party computation, mm-hmm. right? So multiple people participate in this computation. There's some cryptographic elements that allow you to homomorphically steal that information. So none of those people can actually read the information. But it produces meaningful output that the initial requester can actually interpret and process, right? So that's where Fabric sits, is at that layer three. You know, we this is definitely a precision oriented problem, which is part of, and there's a lot of different moving parts as to, you know, that have to be built in order for this to exist. So for the past, you know, couple years since I left Blockstream, you know, I've been building out those components and doing protocol work, building out smaller pieces of software libraries that are part of the system, and we're pretty close to a you know, something that we can actually publish that could be reviewed, I hope, by the community. And with a working demonstration and everything, so we're pretty excited about that. But yeah, that's the overview. That's the 10,000-foot overview without getting into all the crazy math of homomorphic encryption.
Well, so kind of going back to something I referenced earlier, you know, with all the complexity, like how do you deal with like trade-offs of complexity, security, usability? Like how comfortable do you feel building on top of a layer two protocol that's still evolving?
Right. So that's actually a very big portion of the reason why it's taken so long to get where we are, is we love Liquid. We love Lightning. I still like Liquid. I think it's a halfway solution, right? You know, multi-sig, first of all, is actually vulnerable in Bitcoin land, at least the way it's implemented today, until Schnorr signatures get merged, which should be happening soon, and I'm very stoked about that. That and Taproot. I'm a big fan of Lightning, but it is indeed actually very, it's still fairly early, right? So what we ended up doing is we took a much simpler construction for payment channels, and we built our own peer-to-peer network. So we ended up having to also implement a layer two solution that is similar to Lightning, but is much, much more tightly constrained in its capabilities, right?
Gotcha.
Lightning tries to do a lot of different things actually right yeah. now. And there's some really incredible work going on over there between Lalu over at Lightning and Christian Decker at Blockstream. They're both doing incredible work with, you know, multi-path payments and, you know, all sorts of really awesome stuff. But our approach has been to refine everything down to the simplest, the smallest possible use case, and then refine it into a software library that's only doing that one thing, right? So do one thing and do it really well. And ultimately, sometimes we find that a particular problem actually can be divided into three other problems that then we solve individually on those. So we end up with all of these like small pieces that ultimately are composable tools in a toolbox that, you know, you can use to build things down the line. So this is the same kind of atomic approach that the Unix philosophy is, right? It's the same idea that, you know, you don't want your program to get bigger and bigger and do so many different things. You know, you can build higher order complexity from small simple components if you make them composable, right? And in computer science, Jameson, I'm sure you know this stuff, but this idea of functional programming and lambda calculus at large is this idea that you know these individual functions, which only take one input and produce one output, that is that composability. You can put those things together and build higher order functions from them. So just keeping things limited and domain oriented, and not allowing scope creep, which is tough, right? You know, there's always something that we want to build, some cool product or some customer that, you know, we want to, you know, help them build their thing. But it very quickly can expand, and it creates an attack surface, right?
Because so what are some product examples or use cases, specific use cases?
Yeah, Robert? Sure. The biggest customer that we have right now that is probably the best fit is doing medical data processing. So in the U.S. system, I think actually it may be worldwide, but there's this idea of the HIPAA regulation where any medical service provider who is collecting patient data, it's kind of a stupid rule, but basically you have to make your best effort to protect that data from being leaked. With Fabric, we actually have the ability, with homomorphic encryption at large, you have the ability to encrypt that patient information in a way that only the patient can decrypt it, right? And still make it so that medical software and medical providers can generate meaningful information. So, for example, dosages of a certain drug, for example, like if you take in somebody's lab results, you know, and then, you know, you process, pass it into this algorithm, which outputs the appropriate dosage of whatever drug that you want to giving them. That information removing the need for a human oversight in some of these systems. The simpler ones are very clear cut cases of literally no one should ever be able to see that data except for the individual patient, right? Forget this regulation thing and protecting that data. Forget this like idea of using the legal system to and hoping, trusting that this information is safe, right? It would be better if it was simply mathematically impossible for that data to leak, right?
Yeah.
Or for that information to be decrypted. So that's one that I'm super excited about. But we've got a portal, which is it's a trust minimized exchange, basically, that uses the same contract to do what's called dark pool. So encrypted order books, where you put your order in, you can't actually read the order book, and it either executes or it doesn't. So that's really exciting and interesting. But yeah,
amazing. It's exciting. It's really exciting. And I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys end up publishing and the conversation around it. And it's really exciting what's going on in Bitcoin. It's still such early days on all fronts. And to be here with eyes open at this point in the project history is a privilege and an honor, and going to be just a lot of fun to watch unfold. So I want to thank you guys, both of you guys, for your time today. Keep up the great work. Thank you to Casa. Thank you to Eric and the work on Fabric. Really exciting stuff. Thank you guys for tuning in and watching, educating yourself about this very important project, this very important movement in the world today. Continue to educate yourself, continue to stack your sats, swanbitcoin.com, and happy third anniversary to the birth of the BTC Pay server project. You can go to swanbitcoin.com/BTC Pay, and 25% of all of your fees for every purchase you make, every automatic purchase you make, will go to support the project. So check it out. Thanks, guys. That's a wrap.
Thanks. Bye.
On behalf of the Swan team, I'd like to thank Jameson and Eric for taking time to join us today. It was a lot of fun. You can find Jameson on Twitter at Lopp, at LOPP, and Eric is at Martindale, at MARTINDALE. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Swan Signal podcast. It's really fun to join us live on the YouTube broadcast, so if you have a chance to do that sometime, you can hop into the live chat. It's very active there. We often take questions from the listeners there and work them into the conversations. You can find us there at youtube.com/swansignal. And if you are not yet subscribed to this audio podcast, you can find that at swansignalpodcast.com. Swan Signal is a production of Swan Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com, the best way to accumulate Bitcoin with automatic recurring buys. That's it for this week. Take care.